Yeah, so do you want to just go into it? Like, do we need to do a formal intro? We can
I
just
mean,
sort of
just something like
pipe the
hello, everyone.
music in. Yeah, just
Yeah, I
something
get,
like,
we could do a cold open if you want
yeah,
to.
let's do a cold open.
Okay,
I've never done a
cool.
cold open. Let's open
Okay.
a cold one. That's, I mean, the real question here is what beep would you want to open a cold one with?
Oh man.
If you were at a beer summit with one of these, who
See,
would
so,
you get
okay.
along with best?
So I feel like as a Minnesotan, I probably got to go with Tim Walz just because like I would hand him a grain belt and he would know exactly what he was like, okay, I see where this guy's coming from. I see your game. I respect it.
What's a grain belt?
Oh, okay. So a grain belt is one of the best Midwest regional beers that has not like
Oh.
made national level penetration. So like Wisconsin has New Glarus. Lots of people know about Spotted Cow and like that's kind
Spotted
of their
cow, yeah.
famous thing. In the Twin Cities, though, there is this like a light kind of just a pilsner or lager, I guess, that's called Grain Belt. And it is just, it's crisp, it's easy drinking, it's delicious. Yeah, I
See, I was
cannot
picturing an
recommend it enough.
actual belt, some kind of hunting equipment or fishing equipment, something related to what you guys do,
If you are a true Minnesotan and you go out for buck season in the fall, you bring your grain belt, which is where you have it's just a big like ammo sash for you to keep all of your grain belts holstered in.
So you can just pull one out and crack open a
Yes.
cold one while holding a gun. Always a good idea.
What kind of beer do you think JD Vance drinks? Let's be honest here. Cards on the table.
I'm not convinced he drinks beer. I think the thing is that like we got rid of Ron DeSantis and just replaced him with another model of Ron DeSantis. And I have a feeling
Oof.
that he would take a DeSantis-y stance on it and say, oh, my wife never lets me drink those things, or oh, that's empty calories.
Yes. Yeah. I'm doing keto now, man. I can't drink
No,
that.
actually, I guess he did. He was asked about beer, and I don't even know. We might even have that clip, but he was asked about like, what kind of beer do you like?
What kind of beer do you like? Heineken. Heineken? F that shit. Pabst Blue Ribbon.
And he said good beer, I think,
The
which is
most
just like,
normal thing to say in response
yeah.
to that
Clearly,
question.
no, I think probably he would pick like Budweiser, like something very generic that you can drink a lot of. Because he does, I mean,
Yeah.
he's either someone who doesn't drink at all or he's a complete drunk. That's what I get
Yeah.
from
Yeah.
JD Vance.
No, to me, that answer of the good beer reminds me a lot of that Simpsons bit where they're broadcasting, the first televised debate between Kennedy and Nixon.
And now a word from our sponsor.
I would like to take this opportunity to express my fondness for a Duff beer.
I'd also like to express my fondness for that particular beer.
A man never drank a Duff in his life.
And then everybody boos him.
Exactly. Like, that's basically where we're at with these two. They're both competing to be
Yes.
like the most normal, the most like generic suit politician. So I
Yeah.
guess we can jump into it here. We're talking Veep Verb this
Beep
week.
verb.
Veep Verb,
Beep.
where, we're in this weird position now. We haven't, I guess, done an episode about mainstream politics since like the spring, right? Because our last episode was.
Was pre-Joe Biden dropping out. Famously, we did our ethos episode doing an
Yes.
analysis of all the people who are hyping up Joe Biden, saying things like there's no way that he can't, that he can't win. He stays winning. He's winning too much.
Yeah.
And now we're in a very different place a
And
couple months
yeah, and
later.
we were looking at social media discourse about Joe Biden and how the Biden's wins account was sort of creating an ethos for him that was extremely problematic. And now we're in this totally new terrain where Harris is the nominee,
Yes.
and this is kind of an amazing moment because we're looking more closely at Veeps,
Yeah.
at vice presidents. We
Yes.
have one who is running for office, and we have her potential Veep. And we have a very weird Veep on the other side, JD Vance. So this is Veep verb.
It's Veep verb. I also have to say, just to kick things off here, that I mean, obviously, Kamala Harris is herself a Veep. Much hay has been made already, I think, by people on the internet about the fact that there's a famous show out there from HBO or Max, if you will, called Veep, starring the great Julia Louis-Dreyfus as Vice President Selina Meyer. Just an incredible show about the sort of just inhumanness of DC politics and culture, kind of behind the curtain look at the kind of, you know, satirized, but, you know, kind of close to the bone cuts at what DC politics and discourse is really like. Much hay has been made already about how Kamala Harris bears some striking similarities to Vice President Veep Selina Meyer. Particularly, The Daily Show ran a segment about almost a year ago now, showing how their speaking styles are kind of similar in that they circulate around these kind of tautological statements that say very little by saying a lot. Even more hay was made about the fact that there is a plot line on the show Veep about the president sitting POTUS while Selina Meyer is Veep, stepping aside and choosing not to run for re-election. Selina Meyer actually does become the president for a few months, I think, or maybe a year before she then has to run again. Fewer, though, have paid attention to what I think are some of the more striking and creepy similarities between Kamala Harris and Selina Meyer. Particularly, they both have daughters that have been at least nominally for the Palestinian cause. Ella Emhoff famously circulated a link that was raising money for a Palestinian children's relief organization last November, I think it was, sometime around then. There was a plot line in Veep where Catherine Meyer, Selina's daughter, wrote an essay that was critical of Israel and then dated an Iranian boy. It's kind of revenge for her mother's politics. And then finally, the one that to me is the most striking is that they both have presidential running mates who are folksy white guys who are both at risk of outshining them in terms of the kind of comparative sheen that they're getting from the media. Famously, Selina Meyer's running mate Tom James got a lot more shine than her. And there's been a lot of excitement in the air, especially since Tim Walz came onto the scene as Kamala Harris's Veep. So I think that's maybe a good place for us to start. What do you say, Calvin?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think that like this is another weird instance of life imitating art.
Yes.
And where something so on the nose in like contemporary pop culture just becomes real. And it's one of those moments where you're like, we've stepped out of the container here. And I just want to listen and sort of react in the moment, like to this speaking style comparison, just from a rhetorical perspective.
My fellow Americans, words have many meanings, and sometimes instead of conveying our meaning, they can suggest other meanings.
When we talk about the children of the community, they are a children of the community.
We are the United States of America because we are united. And we are states.
Talking about the significance of the passage of time, right? The significance of the passage of time. So when you think about it, there is great significance to the passage of time.
Whatever we have in store cannot be known. The past was once the future. The future is, I should say, unknown.
Unknown. Take the passage of time.
As seriously as you are, because you have been forced to have to take it seriously.
Obesity is a serious disease, and it needs to be taken seriously.
Oh, you need to get to go, and need to be able to get where you need to go to do the work and get home.
I hope that clarifies the issue, and this can be the last word on those words.
Certain issues are just settled.
Clearly, we're not.
No, that's right, and that's why
not.
I do believe that we are living, sadly, in real unsettled times.
Wow.
God.
So cerebral, both of them, frankly.
Yeah, I mean, this is the weirdest thing about being in this moment where Kamala has fully taken the wheel, is that like she, for the longest time, seemed completely rhetorically inept. And especially speaking extemporaneously and like commanding a crowd, I think she's gotten a lot better and like very suddenly.
Yeah, very much
in a way that you have to kind of tip your cap. Like, she's way more convincing on the stump than Joe Biden was. There hasn't been that much time, but like since Obama, this is definitely the most sort of rhetorically in command nominee the Democrats have had. Certainly like more compelling and more convincing and persuasive than Hillary Clinton was, because
yeah.
Hillary Clinton had all that baggage of representing the establishment, like representing a past administration that got two terms, kind of like a permanent fixture. And I think Kamala's been able to sort of hang back throughout Biden's first term. And now she's emerged as like a much more sort of persuasive figure.
Well, and just in the same way that, you know, if you're trying to build a roster with some depth, you know, you got to leave some of your rookies on the bench for a little while. Let them learn from the more seasoned players that have been there for a while. You know, they're there for practice. They're doing all the scrimmages and everything. And then, you know, eventually their iron gets sharpened by just that proximity. But I agree with you. Yeah, I think one of the things that has been so striking about Kamala as a rhetorical figure now is that it's almost like her, you know, what we knew of her in the past, I don't want to say doesn't matter, but I mean, it feels like she has become this kind of blank slate upon which people can project basically just the hope that I think had been at a loss under Joe Biden
during this election.
Yes.
Like,
yes,
not even like it was kind of the combination of kind of a disappointing and chaotic presidency on the part of Biden leading into a really depressing election, a rematch between like two people largely hated on both sides.
Yes.
And so now we have, as you're saying, like a reset, and it calls back to what Obama was able to do so effectively, which is, as you said, like be a blank slate that people projected their hopes onto. Probably the most interesting slogan that Harris and Walz have been using is "We're not going back," which is a fascinating, like, I mean, what I like about it is it does target traditional conservatism in a pretty sharp way. It's saying like traditional conservatism wants to turn back the clock and take away like hard won gains, like reproductive rights and gay rights and all of these other sort of social goods that have been established by like the federal legal regime that the Republican Party has effectively rolled back by packing the Supreme Court. Right.
Yeah.
But yeah, like that slogan has some of the same power that like Obama era slogans had, I think.
Yeah, it is kind of fascinating. I mean, it's to bring a rhetorical concept in here, they are, I think, reading correctly what the kairotic moment really is here, right? Like in the ancient Greek tradition, Kairos is the god who has a great long forelock of hair, but a shaved back of the head. Shout out to Debbie Haughey for her great, great article on Kairos that taught me all about the, you know, you have to grab the forelock as Kairos is flying by. Otherwise, you'll miss it and you'll just scrape the back of his bald head. So we are definitely in a kairotic moment right now, where saying things like "we're not going back" in the face of, you know, the fact that materially some things have turned backwards, you know, the overturning of Roe is probably the biggest thing that is on their minds. And I think that they're doing the right thing by campaigning specifically on those issues from a rhetorical perspective. Just if you've paid attention to voting patterns in the last 4 years, I mean, that really has been the difference maker. It's the, you know, the Republicans are very much on the back foot because of abortion rights being turned back to the states by that Supreme Court decision. So, yeah, they're doing, I think, the right, in the same way that Make America Great Again was a kind of, you know, grotesquely, chirotically appropriate slogan at the time.
Right.
It resonated deeply with this, you know, a vein of affect that was running through the American public. I think they have, you know, they found their fuse right here, and they've really set it off.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that Walz has been instrumental in kind of helping to reset the Democrats rhetorically. I'm not sure if he was the one who coined "we're not going back," but he uses it a lot in his stump speeches. The other really important. I don't know. Do we want to
yeah,
get
we
into
can
this?
Jump into we can jump into the weird. We can go weird.
Right. Right. Let's get weird. So, I mean, Walls is the one who basically coined this idea of reframing Republican politics and Republican politicians as weird, as like these guys are just weird. That's kind yes. of been the applause line for Walls since he was named as Kamala's VP choice. And even before that, when he was kind of going around on talk shows and like gassing up Kamala, he would basically say like, the reason you want to vote for Kamala is these guys are just weird. Like, and we mm-hmm. need someone who will disempower them or prevent them from retaking power. Right. And it's a new approach because we're used to framings that tend to, I don't want to say exaggerate, but certainly like render extremely salient Republican power and highlight the significance and scope of it. But this, I don't want to say it trivializes it, but it renders it more an object of ridicule, right?
Yes.
Than an object of fear.
Right. Yeah. And I think that's what it makes it particularly effective, too, is that not only that it has this kind of, you know, rhetorical device whereby you are diminishing the thing that you are criticizing rather than overinflating it, or to say this thing is really bad and really scary. Also, it's ginormous and huge and powerful. Right. In this way, it is actually rendering them as less powerful as just they're just these little weird guys. Let's actually take a listen to what Tim Walls means when he says they're weird. This is a clip from Jen Psaki's show on MSNBC.
You just need to win more votes to win the election. That's what it's about, as you well know. Now, you've had some, I think maybe your 23-year-old, your 23-year-old governor may have told you that you've gone a little viral lately for basically calling a bunch of Republicans weird. Now, I happen to agree with you when you watch some of these clips, but tell us a little bit more about why you yes. settled on that particular description.
Pull back up that clip of Sebastian Gorka. Weird. There's nothing. That guy's central casting of like a Bond villain, and they continue to be obsessed with things. You know there's something wrong with people when they talk about freedom, freedom to be in your bedroom, freedom being your exam room, freedom to tell your kids what they can read. That stuff is weird. They come across weird. They seem obsessed with this. They continue to try and tell you. And look, the thing that I find the most weird about it is they never do the things they say. I heard one time very early on, you do not need your elected officials to give you a sermon, but they should try and live one. And these guys are weird on how they frame it. They are obsessed. And I said it the other day, the He-Man Woman Haters Club. I don't know where this is coming from.
You get the picture, right? This sort of turning the ideograph of freedom inside out, where saying it's not actually about your freedom that they're talking about. It's right. their freedom to surveil you in all of these different areas where they are these like hyper-obsessed, neurotic people that are looking to like make sure that you're not doing anything, you know, untoward or controversial when you're,
right.
you know, which is, I mean, it's genius. I mean, it so clearly nails something that I think bothers so many people about it, but also renders it understandable, like why so many people on the left have been, you know, raising all these warning flags about the right, doing so in a way that, again, doesn't make them seem powerful. It makes them seem like just these weird busybodies, which, right. Again, is like, I don't know. I haven't seen anything like it before. It feels genuinely novel to me.
Yeah. No, and I think it's also an aesthetic judgment that I think is yeah. really important to register. And it's an effective one, because like the Democrats can win on like aesthetics and culture, because as much as the right makes, you know, a weird and conspiratorial and bizarre kind of argument about like Hollywood and the music industry and like other dominant cultural industries as being more Democrat aligned and being more liberal, it is true at the end of the day. Like, and that stuff is all really popular. Like Taylor right. Swift is a Democrat, and Taylor Swift is like more powerful than virtually every government in the world. Right.
Yeah.
And so when you can make these aesthetic judgments and really run on aesthetics and say like, look at these guys who are their guys. Look at Sebastian Gorka. And he doesn't really get into it so much in that clip, but I think he talks about Vance in a way that, like, he doesn't quite go in for, like, making fun of his visual or physical presentation exactly, but he sort of hints at it in a way that, like, allows the public to draw their own conclusions. And I think, like, Gorka, Vance, even Trump, like, a lot of the major figures on the right now are also weird aesthetically and culturally. And
yeah,
pointing that out, like, that's a winning strategy for Democrats, because at the end of the day, they do have a lot of power in, like, the culture industry and in the determination of, like, what's cool, what's like appealing and cool and, like, fun, you know?
Well, and what's particularly fascinating on that point is, I think we need to reference ethos yet again here. We need to talk about the messenger. I think having Tim Walz be the person who's delivering this message, somebody who crucially is not a lawyer, would be, I think, the first person in the White House, vice president or president, since the Carter administration, I believe, to not be a lawyer or not be trained in law, was a teacher, is, you know, basically, like, is a gun owner, is, like, you know, for Second Amendment rights, but, you know, but has positions on gun control, just, like, presents as this very normal Minnesota guy. Like, you know, Tim Walz, as somebody who grew up in the suburbs of the Twin Cities, feels very typical to me as, like, the kind of guy that would come from there. The fact that he's referencing the He-Man Woman Haters Club in that clip is literally something from The Little Rascals.
Now, what do you say if we form a new club and call it the He-Man Woman Haters Club? Now, I think we ought to have a president. Now, the man we elect must be the worst woman hater of us all. So I nominate Alfalfa because he hates women.
That is like the most Midwest dad core of all reference. You know, the fact that he's making, you do not need your elected officials to give you a sermon, but they should try and live one, kind of inflecting this, like, you know, quasi religiosity into his speaking patterns. He's flanking them on the ordinary guy tip, which Democrats haven't been able to do in a long time, just because the people that they've run have been anything but ordinary, right? They've been people who are members of stereotypically elite institutions. And so I think it does matter, the fact that he is the person with that ethos delivering this message at that moment.
Yeah. And I think it's, like, the closest thing to having Bernie Sanders be, like, a vice presidential nominee, where, you know, it's a lot of the same aspects of, like, just coming across in your affect and speaking style and embodiment as, like, an ordinary guy, and actually having not just, like, the policy record, but the life story to back it up, where, like, you know, he grew up poor, he found his passion, became, like, a kind of inspirational teacher to his students, and his students persuaded him to get into politics because he was, like, a good speaker and a good motivator. That's, you know, it's a cool story, in the same way that, like, Bernie, as an organizer, found his way into politics that way. So, yeah. And, you know, a fair amount has been made of the politics of this choice, that, like, it is kind of a gesture towards the left of the Democratic Party. And I think that some of that is overstated. But at the end of the day, he did get social democratic policies passed in Minnesota that many other states don't have, you know, free school lunches, paid leave, like, things that everyone should have under a social democratic system. And I do think that that's another big change for the Democrats, like, even giving the smallest fig leaf to the left of the party. They really haven't done that for a long time. And Joe Biden was kind of the strongest advocate of not doing that, right?
And for a long time, I mean, I think it was pretty clear that they didn't have to, and that was not a thing that they did not see. The Democratic Party did not see themselves needing to build a coalition with, quote unquote, the left, you know, whatever you take that to mean, like, anything more left of, like, you know, a centrist liberal, that they would not have to do that. I think I mean, one of the things that is worth mentioning right now, and this is not a feather in Tim Walz's cap, is the fact that, you know, right now there is still an ongoing genocide in Gaza. The left is probably more fired up about this as a foreign policy issue, or even just a federal government issue. The fact that we are providing arms to Israel to do this, the fact that we are, you know, sending aid and you know, making, as Harris has, these kind of the remarks about, we are, you know, witnessing this horrible tragedy. It's really hard to countenance. It's, you know, difficult to view these things, but not actually taking any material steps towards a ceasefire, a lasting peace, of just a stopping of the killing. And I think that it's that that intransigence on the part of the Democratic Party has made a lot of people on the left realize we need to really dig our heels in here. Otherwise, like, this is, you know, this is a catastrophe that's impossible to countenance. And I think that's really what has fired up the left, has the uncommitted movement, I think, has in a lot of swing states, particularly Michigan, has made a huge difference in showing the Democratic Party that you do actually need to make concessions to certain groups who are, you know, materially affected by America's foreign policy decisions, as well as, you know, how that redounds to our domestic policy, the way that we fund law enforcement, give more and more power of, you know, both violence and surveillance to our police in a lot of these communities that are also in swing states. It's not just a cynical calculation anymore. I think they really do recognize that they need that.
Yeah, for sure. And I think, you know, it's kind of about signaling more than explicit political statements or positions, where, as you're saying, like, he comes from a state that had a strong uncommitted movement. He Yes. comes from the state that elected Ilhan Omar. It's also just the same region as, you know, the uncommitted movement, the only Palestinian member of Congress, Rashida Tlaib, in Yeah. Michigan. And so it's kind of signaling this kind of Midwest progressive Democrat is who we want on the ticket, signal that we're welcoming people in to support this ticket who otherwise might not. And to say, you know, you probably will have a better chance of getting a ceasefire with this administration than you did with the last Democratic administration. But yeah, at the end of the day, Walz has, you know, supported aid to Israel in the past. He's by no means like a strong fighter for Palestinian freedom, and, you know, and he'll need to be pressured like anyone else on that issue. Yeah. But one thing just on the topic of surveillance, really quickly, to come back to this weird talking point.
Yes.
You know, as this has emerged as part of the Democratic message, it made me think back to some of the work that I did on NSA surveillance, and how one of the things that I saw in my dissertation research into the debate over surveillance in America and how the Snowden leaks in 2013 changed that debate. One of the things I saw was that post Snowden leaks, a lot of the anti-surveillance arguments really highlighted how all-encompassing and significant and massive the surveillance system is, and really tried to kind of scare people into doing something about it by constantly underlining that size and scale and significance. And I was always struck by, I mean, number one, like, I think we can say that that wasn't very effective. Like, NSA surveillance has not been reduced at all since the Snowden leaks. It's been sort of, you know, enshrined as a permanent part of the federal government, and no administration has scaled it back, and no legal decisions have really scaled it back, except for limited individual programs. But one of the things that I was always struck by as an untapped potential argument for reform is that it's creepy and weird. You could see in a lot of the Snowden documents evidence of like the strange kind of subculture of the NSA, these weird like names that they give for programs that feel kind of flip and unserious, as if like it's kind of this permanent 4chan subculture within the government that has access to a ton of our private information and doesn't take that seriously and is having a lot of fun being clever about it and being quirky and bizarre. And so that's another reason that I like this strategy, is kind of attacking power, not, as we've been saying, not by like trying to scare people about it, but by trying to tell them you're better than the people in power. Like, the people in power are weird nerd freaks who want to like exploit you in a really cowardly way, right? And yeah, that you should resist that.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. Boy, what a profoundly disturbing point. We'll link to it. Was any of that in your written communication article at all?
Well, yeah, we'll link to that article. It okay, does come yeah, up we'll link in the to written communication article. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, Calvin's research on that is really fantastic. And yeah, I mean, I think you're exactly right that it is kind of the, you know, again, that threat construction is doing the kind of opposite of making this feel big and bombastic. But again, it's more diminishing. It is pointing to like, look at these weird little guys. What are they trying to do? Are they trying to, they're trying to be in your bedroom. We don't want that.
Yeah. Get them out of there. You know,
get them out of there.
just kind of like sweep them out with a broom, you know? this feels like a great point to go right to Vance.
Let's do it. Yeah. So who are these weird little guys that we're chasing away with our brooms? Well, one of them is named J.D. Vance, and he happens to be on the Veep ticket for President Donald Trump. I just have to ask you, Calvin, did you have a strong reaction one way or the other when J.D. Vance, just days, mere days after the attempted assassination of former President Donald Trump, where that's right, we all forgot about, speaking of a chaotic moment, the fact that Biden dropped out like a week after Donald Trump had an attempt on his life, I gotta say, just from a purely rhetorical standpoint, kind of a brilliant tactical move, because it totally subsumed any of the news cycle talking about Trump's assassination attempt.
And I think we could say that Trump himself and Vance really missed their chaotic moment.
Yes, they did.
To use that incredibly shocking event for all of the political juice that it was inherently filled with. They got nothing out of that.
Well,
it was shocking.
I think it was too. I mean, not to give sympathy to the devil here, but like, it, you know, from Trump's perspective, like, I would be horribly rattled if something like that happened.
Sure.
It's maybe a little bit understandable that he doesn't want to make a lot of hay out of that. I mean, he is like the most TV brained and like optics brained
That's the thing.
Person in politics of all time. But I mean, you know, that thing literally, the bullet missed his ear by like a quarter of an inch. Like,
it's true.
he came that close to dying. That is insane. I mean, how could you not be moved in on like a deep spiritual level by that, even if that is moving you away from trying to be a ruthless political campaigner, right?
I think the reason I was surprised they didn't get more out of it rhetorically is that he seemed to have the correct instinct in the moment to make such a photo op out of it.
Yes, and, for sure.
And I was sort of surprised even, I've been surprised even that the photo has not been a stronger, like, I think Kara Finnegan calls it a visual ideograph.
Yeah.
Like, for the right. I've been kind of shocked by that. Like, it I think they're trying to make it one.
They are.
But it hasn't really circulated enough to change the conversation about the election. Maybe because it doesn't really, like, change anything about their arguments. He's kind of always been this outsider figure, or he's kind of always embraced like this weird sense of martyr. Not, I don't know. Actually, in his rhetoric, he doesn't embrace a sense of martyrdom or a sense of like
victimhood.
But I think his followers often construct him that way.
Yeah.
And so it just didn't shift the frames enough to be a powerful symbol.
I mean, my sense is that that it was actually like a big boon for his base, like the people who are all in for Donald Trump, the visual ideograph of him being nearly assassinated, of, you know, standing in front of the flag, fist in the air with blood running down the side of his face, saying, fight, fight, fight. I mean, I've seen guys walking around with T-shirts of that.
You have?
even yes, here in Connecticut. It's crazy. But, and you know, he got, famously, the streamer Aiden Ross gave Trump a Cybertruck with that photo emblazoned on the side of it, which just, you know, I mean, is horrifying in so many different ways. But I could also see why, again, the people who are fans are making hay out of it, because
Trump
himself doesn't seem to want to talk about it, or really like say like they're out for me, you know, they're what is the meme, it's the they're not aiming at me, they're aiming at you, I'm just in the way or whatever,
right.
And which,
right,
again, seems like that could have been a layup for a political line, but this might be one of those things where the sort of cynically minded, you know, rhetorical figure of Trump is actually facing like pure animal fear for the first time, and is having, I think, what would strangely be a normal response to that.
To trauma.
To trauma. Yeah. Yeah. I don't mean to make light of it.
He's trauma dumping on all of us. I think the thing is that also he might feel that it makes him look weak.
Folks, no, I'm going to therapy. I'm going to see my cognitive behavioral therapist.
My analyst.
I'm learning many grounding strategies, folks. It's very good.
No, sorry. But no, I really,
this is somebody who's in therapy and does all that.
I really do think that he's afraid of any framing that might make him seem weak. And so he couldn't embrace it because he was a victim of an attack.
Yeah.
And he has to always be strong and always be in control.
Yep.
But yeah, so that was surprising.
And then
as you said, the Democrats did a great job of just completely steamrolling it with Biden dropping out and Kamala naming walls.
Well, and another piece of trauma that was buried under the announcement of Biden dropping out was, as we alluded to earlier, J.D. Vance joining, yes, the ticket.
Right. So you were asking me what my reaction was when J.D. Vance was named. I think that I had the exact reaction that a lot of people had, which was like, what is this adding? Other than similar to, you know, the effect of that photo op, like reinforcing his power with people he already has power with. It felt to me like Vance is very much like in the fever swamps of, if not the far right, like the mainstream right, you know, and the mainstream right that expresses itself in some of the tones and tropes of fascism, that it didn't seem like a base expanding move at all.
I don't think so either. It's important to note. So J.D. Vance was a mentee of Peter Thiel, famous right-wing libertarian billionaire, who also was an advisor to Trump in his early years of his presidency, was kind of this, you know, handpicked politician, was bankrolled in a big way by Thiel during, mm-hmm, his Ohio Senate race. And, you know, allegedly was also a major voice in Trump's ear for the VP pick this year. So, I mean, J.D. Vance is coming out of this long lineage of cultural conservatism mixed with libertarianism, but rooted in this fascist aesthetic of, mm-hmm, the entirety of politics is centered around the heterosexual patriarchal family structure. That is the sort of basic unit of politics. One of Vance's weird lines that he, you know, at one point had trotted out is basically saying, like, we want to expand the franchise for people who have children. Like, the more children you have, the more votes you have in your household or something, mm-hmm, like that.
Let's give votes to all children in this country, but let's give control over those votes to the parents of those children. Children are the future of this country. And yet, the parents who have them actually have no advantage in our democratic process. They have a smaller voice in some ways than the people who don't have any children at all.
So, you know, he is this arch cultural conservative coming at politics from this very like culturally centered view. That is, of course, masquerading a lot of conservative economic policies that go into that as well. That's very important to mention, and something that I'm sure we'll get into when we look at some of his artifacts here. But rhetorically speaking, I mean, there's so much that you can say in contradistinction to Tim Walz, the normal Minnesota dad guy, to J.D. Vance, the weirdo Ohio-born, Yale Law School graduated, San Francisco venture capitalist expat turned Ohio senator. Where do you want to start, Calvin?
Yeah, I mean, I think we should start with some of these really cringy lines that have, you know, it seems like at this point, the Democrats can kind of coast to this election just by circulating clips of things that he's said, either in the past or recently. And so we have several of those here that we can look at.
We're effectively run in this country via the Democrats, via our corporate oligarchs, by a bunch of childless cat ladies who are miserable at their own lives and the choices that they've made. And so they want to make the rest of the country miserable, too. If you look at Kamala Harris, Pete Buttigieg, AOC, the entire future of the Democrats is controlled by people without children.
So interesting line of rhetorical advance here, saying that because these people do not have a stake in the future of the country in the form of children, they cannot be trusted to lead. I don't know. As a cat guy, Calvin, what did you make of this line?
Yeah, I mean, it's just not very persuasive, particularly in a country where, like, a lot of people have legitimate economic reasons for not having kids. And I think, like, again, this doesn't expand the base that Trump needs to expand to win. It kind of reinforces, like, the sort of nuclear family obsessed conservative ideology that we already associate really strongly with the Republican Party. And like, it's also a bad framing when they're trying to get away or they're trying to sort of distract people from the fact that they've rolled back reproductive rights. If you're talking about like, you should be more or less forced to have children if you want to have a stake in the way the country is run, that's going to remind people that you are responsible for forced birth across the country in a lot of states.
Yes.
Right. And so I think that's another way in which this line of rhetoric is ineffective. But there's also just, it's just on its face not convincing, because AOC and frankly Kamala seem way happier than him. And so they've clearly like found some kind of like balance in their lives. If it's like not having kids, if it's having cats, if it's having stepkids, whatever it is, like they seem to be coping much better with life than J.D. Vance is.
Yeah, the number one rule for seeming normal, I think, is to actually show yourself as being able to experience emotions other than just rage and just vitriol at all times. So when J.D. Vance does do that, let's take a look at what that sounds like. So this is J.D. Yes. Vance trying to express his affection for something that he really likes. Let's take a listen.
It is the weirdest thing to me. Democrats say that it is racist to believe. Well, they say it's racist to do anything. I had a Diet Mountain Dew yesterday and one today. I'm sure they're going to call that racist too, but it's good. I love you guys.
Yeah, see, that's the most Ron DeSantis moment I think that he's had so far, where it's like, it's good. The kind of like talking about the Mountain Dew as like, it's good. You know, what do you want me to say? That's something that Ron DeSantis would totally say in that exact voice.
And absolutely.
Like, what? This is where we're having a contest of like weird. The other side is weird claims. That's just so unfair to the Trump campaign, where it's
the
like
deck is stacked. Yeah.
Yeah. This guy can't pull it off, because even in like trying to make an argument that the Democrats are weird because they call everything racist, like he says something incredibly weird to make the argument.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, the other reason that that's ineffective is that, I mean, you could just as easily lob back, like, if you take his point of like, oh, they call everything racist, it's like, well, you call everything woke. So, you know, there's not
exactly.
really a,
exactly.
there's not, when you can draw too much of an easy equivalence there, you can't, yeah, there's not really anything
push the
to stand on
at all.
Yeah, exactly. But let's maybe talk about a little bit more about who J.D. Vance is. I mean, when did you first hear about J.D. Vance, Calvin?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it would have to be when his book Hillbilly Elegy was making the rounds. And this was really a liberal darling book for a while there, where it was sort of like helping liberals to understand the sort of forgotten man that voted for Donald Trump in 2016. I would say this is an example of something, I mean, sort of the whole phenomenon around Hillbilly Elegy, it getting so popular and being used in that way, is an example of something that we've talked about on the show in the past, which is overinterpreting 2016.
Yes.
And saying 2016 told us something totally new about America. We need to revise all of our assumptions and find all of these like oracles of white working classness to help us understand what we got wrong. Like, again, I mean, we'll get into kind of how he talks about his hillbilly upbringing, but like, at the end of the day, that election was so close and so overdetermined by so many things that 2016, like, you should almost throw out any claims that people make about like what we learned about America from it, other than that maybe it's not hard to run a total like celebrity political amateur and have him like squeak out a win in a really messed up political system with an electoral college, right? Like, other than that, we learned nothing from that election that can really be transferred to subsequent elections, I think.
Yeah. I mean, I said we were going to keep coming back to Cairo. So as promised, like every Cairotic moment is different. Yes. And to pretend that, you know, what is the sort of timely thing to bring up or to say or how to appear, how to effectively campaign in 2024, comparing that to old Cairotic moments is a fruitless endeavor. And I think kind of a red herring, if you like, for looking at politics. It's much more, I think, useful to try and chart out what is the rhetorical situation that we're in right now. Mm-hmm. But I think that, you know, Republicans are equally suffering from that kind of, you know, myopia right now, pretty much presuming that we can just run this guy who won in 2016, lost in 2020 because it was stolen, allegedly, quote unquote. But then also, like, just running this guy who only really made sense in the year 2016, whose fame only came about because he was riding the tailwind of Donald Trump, who at the time said that he didn't even like Donald Trump, said that he was, you know, like, you know, Hitler light or Hitlerite or something like that. It was basically saying that, like, you know, this guy, I'm not a fan. I'm a never Trump guy.
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 I never liked him.
I'm a never Trump guy.
I'm a never Trump guy.
I'm a never Trump guy.
Never.
I'm a never Trump guy.
Never.
I'm a never Trump guy.
Never.
I'm a never.
But was indeed being read as this kind of codex for understanding the rural white working class. And I want to play a little bit from, because I think we want to do a little bit of a rhetorical comparison from what J.D. Vance used to sound like back in 2016, back in the Hillbilly Elegy era, when, as Calvin said, he's ascending, he, you know, is this kind of liberal darling for trying to, even though he himself is not a liberal, has always been conservative, is being upheld as this kind of Rosetta Stone, if you like, for understanding the white working class of rural America, the forgotten people. So let's take a listen to his TED Talk, America's Forgotten Working Class, from October of 2016.
But if you think of where I'm from, in the South, in Appalachia, in Southern Ohio, it's very unlikely that kids like that will rise. The American dream in those parts of the country is, in a very real sense, just a dream. So why is that happening? So one reason is obviously economic or structural. So you think of these areas, they're beset by these terrible economic trends built around industries like coal and steel that make it harder for folks to get ahead. That's certainly one problem. There's also the problem of brain drain, where the really talented people, because they can't find high-skill work at home, end up moving elsewhere, so they don't build a business or nonprofit where they're from. They end up going elsewhere and taking their talents with them. There are failing schools in a lot of these communities, failing to give kids the educational leg up that really makes it possible for kids to have opportunities later in life. These things are all important. I don't mean to discount these structural barriers, but when I look back at my life and at my community,
something else was going on, something else mattered. It's difficult to quantify, but it was no less real. So for starters, there was a very real sense of hopelessness in the community that I grew up in. There was a sense that kids had that their choices didn't matter. No matter what happened, no matter how hard they worked, no matter how hard they tried to get ahead, nothing good would happen. So that's a tough feeling to grow up around. That's a tough mindset to penetrate. And it leads sometimes to very conspiratorial places. So let's just take one political issue that's pretty hot, affirmative action. So depending on your politics, you might think that affirmative action is either a wise or an unwise way to promote diversity in the workplace or the classroom. But if you grow up in an area like this, you see affirmative action as a tool to hold people like you back. That's especially true if you're a member of the white working class. You see it as something that isn't just about good or bad policy. You see it as something that's actively conspiring, where people with political and financial power are working against you. And there are a lot of ways that you see that conspiracy against you, perceived, real, but it's there and it warps expectations.
So I just wanted to share that as an example of kind of the way that J.D. Vance is triangulating his understanding of the very real economic precarity of people in, as he's saying, Appalachia, you know, the Rust Belt, people who are sort of forgotten because they were part of these industries that experienced a huge boom in the 19th and early 20th centuries, and then the bottom dropped out through either, you know, a lack of demand or through offshoring of jobs to other places around the world, and is saying basically, yeah, well, all those structural factors are, you know, I'm not trying to discount those, but there's this cultural feeling of hopelessness and just this conspiracy mindset that you know gets instilled in these people. I mean, his book Hillbilly Elegy, from my understanding, I haven't read it, but I've listened to enough people talk about it who talk about it as this kind of very harsh condemnation of the people that he grew up with, and saying that basically it's because they, you know, have a bad attitude and they can't pull themselves up by their bootstraps. They are conspiracy minded because there's something wrong with them personally. And if they made better choices, then they could advance themselves economically. And it's almost like, I mean, you know, he said all the answers right there. Like, he had the answer key open with like all of the economic and structural problems there. And then he's like, but actually it's affirmative action that's poisoning these people's brains and causing them to think in this conspiracy mindset. I don't know. What did you think of that clip, Calvin?
Yeah. I mean, I had the same reaction. Like, yeah, the answer was right there, but you chose to pivot away from it and really take this view of like culture and affect. I mean, I know that people and critics of Hillbilly Elegy in the past have acknowledged the similarity in his analysis of the white working class to very elitist analyses of the black working class, especially in the mid 20th century to today. These claims that the thing that has held back the black working class from advancing is culture. It's like adopting these cultural role models who are not positive. It's focusing more on petty crime as ways to make money rather than going to school, like all of these sort of cultural critiques that ignore the structures that force people into certain positions, right?
Yeah.
And J.D. Vance really does kind of do that same thing, but for the white working class, mm-hmm. saying it's their culture that's the problem. It's nothing economic. There are all of these economic things going on, but at the end of the day, they have like bad vibes, and we need to fix those vibes, and then they'll get ahead. And I think this is a really convenient way of looking at the world if you don't want to actually change the economic structures, right?
Yes.
So, I mean, that's one of the things that jumped out at me. It also just jumps out at me as a genre point that this guy is a TED Talk speaker. You know, he's very much speaking in the genre of a TED Talk, and to then try to pivot, especially in this current election, to say that you are the everyman, that you come from American normalcy, that you define American normalcy, and that you will have the backs of like ordinary working class Americans when you have mastered the TED Talk genre, which is like so elite and is so like tech wealth associated. Yeah. I think is a really hilarious hypocrisy, you know?
Absolutely. And it makes sense at the time. I mean, I think at that point he was in San Francisco, like based there and part of a venture capital firm in the Bay Area or in Silicon Valley. So, I mean, he's trying to have the best of both worlds. He's trying to have his cake and eat it too, right? I can represent both the hillbillies from Appalachia. I can also represent the moneyed interests of Silicon Valley and the elites who went to Yale. Yeah, he's trying to have it both ways.
Right. And I think we can get a little better sense of like how he tells that life story from his acceptance speech for the VP this year from the Republican National Convention. And so let's listen to a little bit of that and then just compare the rhetoric across the two. So we're at the point in JD's speech where he's going to talk about his mama and how she kind of defined his values and who he was as a young person, and then his life story after that. His mama is his grandma. That's what he calls her.
Now, I was lucky. Despite the closing factories and the growing addiction in towns like mine, in my life, I had a guardian angel by my side. She was an old woman who could barely walk, but she was tough as nails. I called her Mamaw, the name we hillbillies gave to our grandmothers. Mamaw raised me as my mother struggled with addiction. Mamaw was in so many ways a woman of contradiction. She loved the Lord, ladies and gentlemen. She was a woman of very deep Christian faith. But she also loved the F word. I'm not kidding. She could make a sailor blush. Now, she once told me, when she found out that I was spending too much time with a local kid who was known for dealing drugs, that if I ever hung out with that kid again, she would run him over with her car. That's true. And she said, JD, no one will ever find out about it.
Mamaw.
Now, thanks to that Mamaw, things worked out for me. After 9/11, I did what thousands of other young men my age did in that time of soaring patriotism and love of country. I enlisted in the United States Marines. Semper Fi to my fellow Marines. Now, I left the Marines after 4 years and went to the Ohio State University. I'm sorry, Michigan. I had to get that in there.
He's in Wisconsin right now, by the way. He's getting his Big Tens mixed up.
Yeah.
Come on. We've had enough political violence. Let's...
What?
After Ohio State, I went to Yale Law School, where I met my beautiful wife. And then I started businesses to create jobs in the kind of places that I grew up in. Now, my work taught me that there is still so much talent and grit in the American heartland. There really is. But for these places to thrive, my friends, we need a leader who fights for the people who built this country.
All right, let's stop it there. So, yeah, what did you make of this? So this is JD 8 years later. Now he has a beard. Talking a little bit differently. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, yeah, he certainly doesn't have quite the meek, like NPR core TED Talk voice going on. He's got a little bit of a little bit more gruff in his voice now.
Yeah.
But he also... I don't know. I mean, that was such a strange anecdote to share for people who who are listening to this, you couldn't see the reactions from the crowd. But I mean, you know, you heard them start chanting "Mama, Mama" after she was saying that she's going to run a drug dealer over with her car. So, I mean, it's like, it's leading me to think that these are like, you know, like to bring in an international metaphor, like these are like Rodrigo Duterte supporters here. These are people who are for like summarily executing drug dealers or drug users in the streets. You know, yeah, the applause line is she said she was going to run him over with his car. I was expecting a kind of detour of the lock her up chance to start run him over, run him over.
Yeah. So, for real. Like, well, and then there's just a tossed off joke about political violence in there too.
I mean, what was that? Just like,
oh my God, he admitted, you know?
Oh my God, he admitted.
Like, here we go again.
So
there's that, there's that, but we should also put a really fine point on the pivot in his story when, you know, it's all like Appalachia, Appalachia, mamaw, 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 and then Yale Law School and this deeply bizarre line about starting companies to help people in the places places like where I came from. Do you know what that's a reference to in his career? Like, do you have like a startup that was about helping hillbillies?
He did, yes. So he did actually have a nonprofit that he started in Ohio. Let me just do a quick research. This was pre-senatorial campaign. He had a charity that, let me see, he just dissolved it as of the time of this recording, 6 minutes ago, they reported that he dissolved the vestiges of a charitable effort he launched in Ohio after the publication of his best-selling memoir, Hillbilly Elegy. He advanced formed two like-named nonprofits. This is the AP reporting, starting in 2016 to address problems in Ohio and other Rust Belt states. They were primarily supposed to focus on boosting job opportunities, improving mental health treatment, and combating the opioid crisis. The original organization folded within 5 years, and Vance put the other on hold when he successfully ran for Senate in 2022. So he faced criticism, it says here, during the race over how little the group's accomplished, despite Vance's stated intentions to identify and produce national solutions to these problems. The nonprofit's only notable achievement was paying to send an addiction specialist to Southern Ohio for a year who had questioned the well-documented role of prescription painkillers in the national opioid crisis. So anyway, not much. It was more of a sop to this notion of like nonprofits or businesses or 501c3s, whatever you want to call them, are going to be the solution to all of our problems. It's the privatization of the social safety net, which is kind of par for the course with a lot of these guys.
I mean, that just struck me as a really kind of humorous rhetorical sleight of hand there, where it's like, I graduated from law school, became an economical elite, but I was doing it to help the people where I came from. And there's really no kind of, that's just tossed off. There's no real exploration of that, because if you actually got into his career after he grew up, you would see how different he is from those people, how alienated he is from those people, and therefore how weird he is in the eyes of probably most of those people.
Yeah, no, I think that there's a very strong sense that you get from looking at somebody like J.D. Vance that he just doesn't mean it, you know, like no matter what he's doing, he's always cosplaying something. Like,
yes,
to what degree is he a real hillbilly? I mean, if you read his book, even it sounds like he's like, yeah, you know, screw these people. I tried to get out of that backwater as fast as I could.
Right. But then he also in that life story completely skips over becoming a best-selling author.
Yes.
Which seems very salient. That
would be prudent
that
to mention. Because he was only, I mean, I think he was only 32 at the time that came out. I mean, he was young. He still is young. It is a big portion of his life that he has spent since Hillbilly Elegy that has been riding off of the momentum of that book. And so, yeah, it is kind of conspicuous that he leaves that out. Although I think that in many ways just kind of is supposed to become part of his mythos. It is interesting that he talks about the sort of grit that you find in the heartland, which is in kind of contradistinction to the description of how hopeless parts of the Rust Belt can be and just how like it feels so impossible to get ahead. That sense of pessimism has kind of gone away now, and he's more sort of just valorizing the place where he came from. almost, you might say, doing some identity politics. I don't know. Maybe somebody right. more cynical than me might say that. But no, seriously. I mean, it does seem like he's trying to do this kind of cynical appeal to, you know, being able to say both. I am someone who comes from, you know, the hill people, and I've also rubbed shoulders with some of the most rich and powerful people in the world. I'm a great businessman, yada, yada, yada. You know, you should vote for me because I check all of the boxes of the things you people are supposed to like. Like that right. kind of, that always has kind of felt like what J.D. Vance presents. And yeah, I mean, I don't know. It comes off as really superficial and stilted and weird.
Yeah, for sure. And so, I mean, I think picking up on what you just said, I think we should wrap things up here with a discussion of the trope of weirdness.
Yes.
And how this is manifesting in these different rhetorics, because it is like an interesting theoretical question of what does it mean to be normal and what does it mean to be weird in a rhetorical sense? And it is fascinating to see that a contest over weirdness and normalcy is really defining this election. And yeah. So obviously just act normal, that sort of admonition has been tossed off as an epithet at a lot of marginalized people over the years.
Absolutely.
And so it's not an unproblematic statement to make, devoid of context. But where do we go to like kind of understand the meaning of weirdness and normalcy in this election?
Yeah, it's a really important question. I mean, just to take a kind of look at the word history of the word normal, right? There's a great article by Alexander Kiosev, The Oxymoron of Normality, that talks about how in the early to mid 1800s, there was what he calls a kind of conceptual colonization that took place in Europe over this word normal, that it actually went from being this the thing that was mainly only defined in specialist fields of science and technology to something that more permeated everyday life. It became, in a sort of Foucauldian sense, a biopolitical gesture, right? Normal, he writes, becomes a designation for the internalized, routine, self-evident modern order, a designation that conceals its disciplinary and technological character, which I think is kind of important, right? That the idea of social norms kind of, you know, emerges out of this, you know, this sense that in order to have a society, you need to have, you know, these sort of internalized, self-evident, kind of almost routinized and automatic ways of behaving. And I think to a lot of us, that's probably not a very controversial thing to say. But what Kiosev is sort of gesturing at here by way of talking about Foucault and biopolitics is that there's always a disciplinary mechanism in there, in that you right. can always create this distinction between normal and deviant, that, you know, the concept of normal, as with most binary concepts, always implies its opposite, that there is going to be a deviant against which the normals have to define themselves. And so in a strange way, I think we can actually look at this election cycle as a kind of reversal of the normal deviant kind of spectrum. Dichotomy. It was more of sort of like the Republicans in 2016 were kind of playing into the deviant aspects of what they were doing in a way that was attempting to kind of break through the stultifying normalcy of, you know, democratic norms and things of that nature. Whereas now, the normal has itself become kind of a deviant gesture or a way of, you know, being able to poke fun at somebody for being abnormal or deviant in the sense of like J.D. Vance and Donald Trump, which I think is very fascinating that process of normalization has kind of undergone such a transformation over the last almost decade now. I don't know. What do you make of the cycle of normalization as we've been experiencing it?
Yeah, I mean, I think what we're seeing in some ways is that normal is defined by each social group. And so if that social group is comprised in a way that's not inherently hierarchical and unequal along lines of like race, gender, disability, and other sort of prime, you know, overwhelmingly accidental aspects of identity, that norm defining and normalizing processes are just part of establishing a social group. And so I feel like Toon Van Dyke, who we've referenced a lot on this podcast, has a very succinct way of talking about normalization, that it's something that he says, quote, for social group members to know that specific factual or evaluative beliefs are shared by most or many other members, a process of normalization should take place. Own beliefs based on personal experiences need to be compared with those of others. He goes on to say, quote, speakers belonging to a group who are talking to other members construct models of their interlocutors and their beliefs and may generalize such models to social representations featuring the shared beliefs of the own group. So basically what Van Dyke is getting at is that we kind of come to establish norms just in the process of constituting a group. And I think what the Democrats are doing is saying, this is who we are as a group. These are the values that we hold, like gender equality, racial equality, like these sort of straightforward liberal values. And it's actually weird not to hold those beliefs. It's abnormal, right? And they're kind of, they're forthrightly marking those norms and marking how the Republicans, specifically J.D. Vance with his kind of weird fever swamp online right-wing politics and you know, proud white identity politics, that marking those as like out-group members from the in-group of liberal democratic politics. And in that way, it is a kind of more confrontational politics, but I think it's productive because they clearly have a bigger group. They can win more people by constituting that group of like, here are our norms. And isn't it weird not to hold these norms? Let's acknowledge that directly, you know?
Yeah. And I mean, like Van Dyke is talking about here, it's an act of recognition, not only of like, you know, constituting who belongs to this set of norms, you know, that we speak in this way, we believe these things, we practice this kind of, you know, these gestures towards other people, but also pointing at the opposite of it and saying, these people do not belong. These people are part of the out group. And specifically doing so in a way that, just to connect this back to Kairos again, just like fits so well for the exact moment that we're in. It takes a lot of, I think, rhetorical prowess to be able to establish a new normativity. And the fact that it's being done in many ways through like this online discourse of the weird memification of the Republican Party, and seeing how so many of them are responding to it in digital spaces by just getting weirder, like
doubling down.
Donald Trump just did a Twitter space an X space with Elon Musk the other day that, by all accounts, I didn't listen to any of it, but by all accounts was just a very strange conversation.
Super strange. And it went on for like 4 hours. So it was like an episode of the Joe Rogan Experience or something like that.
Only the real weirdos are going to sit for all that. Like nobody, that's too long. That's too long for most people who don't spend all of their time on the freaking internet. And that's largely, I think, what another kind of distinction point here is too, right, is that the Democrats, I think, this election seem to be tapping into, as you said, a wider well of, you know, possible norms and identities and subjectivities that can fit under the umbrella of like who is included in our new normal. The Republicans are not. They have constantly been sort of like winnowing down their support group by making it so much about like this weird veiled yet not so veiled like white identitarianism that, I mean, yeah, the only votes that they can maybe, I mean, I don't want to prognosticate or to, you know, predict anything prematurely here, but it seems like they're really narrowing their audience for this, right? That they are really making a bad strategic decision by saying like, well, yeah, we don't care about all the you know, the people who might be affected by policies like affirmative action, like the TED Talk J.D. Vance was referencing earlier. Like, we are only paying attention to not even the white working class specifically, but people who fetishize the white working class.
Yeah, and people who make memes about the white working class.
Yeah. And again, to most of us, That's weird.
That's weird. Like, to draw a picture of a white working class guy who you think is cool and like send that to your friends. That's weird. And but I did want to make a critical point here about this Democratic Party rhetoric, because, you know, it comes back to what we talked about on our last episode. If you want to adopt the mantle of normalization and establishing your norms forthrightly and saying, like, this is what we believe in, if you don't hold these beliefs, you're weird, then you do really have to explain and clarify who's included within that and who's excluded, and whether those inclusions and exclusions are in fact about values and not about identities and other accidents of people's birth or people's circumstances. And I do think the Democratic Party has this continuing issue of trying to run to the right and compete with the Trump campaign to the right on issues of immigration, issues of criminal justice, issues of Israel and Palestine, right? Mm-hmm. If you continue to say, we strongly support a closed border, we strongly support increased funding for police to like over police and surveil and harass poor people and Black people and other minorities and marginalized groups, we support the endless slaughter of Palestinians. If you do that, you are very clearly saying those people also fall outside of the norm. Undocumented people fall outside of our norm, people targeted by police, and, you know, people oppressed by the Israeli Defense Forces fall outside of our norm, and people who support all of those groups, right?
Yep.
And so it does become a double-edged sword where you want to establish this really strong in-group. It should be as inclusive as possible, and it has to include some of those groups that you are actively excluding with your policies and with your policy rhetoric.
Yeah. Well, and it's important to note too that, I mean, like, again, that's like, it's not just a moral point here, which I think is probably the superordinate concern, right? It is immoral
to exclude all those people rhetorically.
Yes. But at the same time, it's also strategically important to take a hardline stance on some of these. YouGov and the IMEU policy projects polled Pennsylvania, Georgia, and Arizona, and basically found that in Pennsylvania, if the Democrats and independents were asked, are you more or less likely to support a Democratic nominee who pledges to withhold weapons to Israel? You know, basically like materially preventing further violence, further genocide. In Pennsylvania, 34% of those said they were more likely, 7% less likely. In Georgia, 39% were more likely to support the nominee who does that versus 5% who wouldn't be. Arizona, 35% would vote with that nominee versus 5% who would be less likely. It's not hard in any world.
There is electoral benefit to making your tent as big as possible. And part of that is like including young people and Palestinians and other people who sympathize with that cause. You include them by, you know, backing that cause and creating policies that back that cause.
Yeah. Yeah. Rather than, I mean, and again, this is part of one of the issues that I think will be important to pay attention to. If the Harris Walls campaign does indeed succeed, but we continue to see genocide that continues to be perpetrated in Gaza by the IDF, whether or not, you know, protest and civil disobedience on the home front will continue to be prosecuted in the way that it has been by university leaders, by municipal police, state police, even, you know, Tim Walz infamously called the National Guard in on Black Lives Matter protesters in Minneapolis, right? We need to keep holding a line here and keep holding the, you know, people in power to account. Otherwise, that normalization process that got us, you know, an electorally successful campaign here could also be weaponized against the very causes that they purport to support. So that's the one thing I would leave it off with is, you know, is continue to be normal, but not too normal.
Well, and just, you know, make that normalization about values, not about excluding groups and targeting and surveilling groups, because then you just end up repeating a kind of neoconservative normalization that you know, really, really skyrocketed during the second Bush administration after 9/11, and that we're still dealing with today, that defines so much of our politics. Like, you don't want to embrace that type of normalization because it did a lot of damage to a lot of people.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I think we did it. Beep verb.
Beep verb. There it was, folks, trying to understand U.S. politics in mid to late 2024 through the lens of the vice presidential picks.
I mean, it's, yeah, this is really the linchpin that's tying our politics together right now is Veeps. It's all about
it. Veeps. Is. It's the, you know, hillbilly to Yale pipeline people versus the Minnesota teachers turned governors. We are going, exactly, the Minnesota dads versus the fake hillbilly Appalachians. We'll see who comes out victorious here.
Yeah, the people who taught English in China versus the people with best-selling books. I know which side I'm on.
Me too.
But hey, man, this is a lot of fun, and we'll see where it goes. And thank you to everyone for tuning in. We will be back with much more Reverb content soon, and we hope that you have a lovely start of your new semesters if you're listening to us as you're getting ready to teach again in the fall.
Yes. Enjoy it, everyone. It was great getting to chat about this. Until next time, bye-bye, everybody.
Bye-bye. Beep verb.
Beep verb.
Our show today was produced by Alex Helberg and Calvin Pollock, with editing work by Alex. Reverb's co-producers at large are Ben Williams, Sophie Wadzak, and Olivia Burnett. You can subscribe to Reverb and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Android, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Check out our website at www.reverbcast.com. You can also like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter, where our handle is at ReverbCast. That's R-E-V-E-R-B underscore C-A-S-T. If you've enjoyed our show and want to help amplify more of our public scholarship work, please consider leaving us a 5-star review on your podcast platform of choice and tell a friend about us. We sincerely appreciate the support of our listeners. Thanks so much for tuning in.